Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each episode we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today we are talking about Gladiator, directed by Ridley Scott, screenplay by David Franzoni, John Logan, and William Nicholson. I'm joined by part of the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
And also joining us today are fellow video essayists and podcasters, Tom Vinderlinden, who you may know from his YouTube channel, Like Stories of Old.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And Thomas Flight, who you may know from his YouTube channel, Thomas Flight.
Hi, happy to be here.
Excellent. Yes, welcome to the show. We're very excited to have you guys here. We've been scheduling this for a long time, and I'm glad we finally made this happen. We have several patrons that are big fans. Kalki, shout out. So I think they're going to be people that are very excited that we have you guys here.
Nice.
So before we dive into Gladiator, for our listeners, I want to say that our next episode is going to be on Alien, the original Alien, which I've now realized, Trisha, that we accidentally did a Ridley Scott trilogy.
I know. It's a little embarrassing that we didn't even think about it.
Yeah.
But what a trilogy it is.
Indeed. We just talked about Thelma and Louise, and so now we're talking about Gladiator and then Alien. So everyone prepare yourselves for that. Also before we dive into Gladiator, so Tom, Thomas, you guys have a podcast, Cinema of Meaning. What made you want to start a podcast? Who are you? If I'm a new listener, TLDR, tell me about yourselves and what your podcast is about.
Yeah, so Cinema of Meaning is for everyone who wants to go even further beyond the screenplay.
Oh,
I'm throwing down.
We're so far beyond the screenplay, we barely talk about it at all. But
I see.
But we obviously are big fans of Beyond the Screenplay, and we thought it would be a fun format for ourselves as well, just because we've been doing video essays on our own and we've been looking for something to do together because it's just more fun. And especially the conversational format is, for me at least, really helpful to really trigger like new ideas and to really dive into a movie. And so, yeah, that's basically the setup of Cinema of Meaning. We talk about a movie each week and we really try to focus on the deeper themes, the deeper meanings. So we have a bit more of a philosophical or like thematic angle to it. And yeah, it's been lots of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's also a very conversational show, right? Like I listened to it for the first time. I was like, oh, this is like very like natural and organic. And I feel like anyone that likes Beyond the Screenplay is going to like Cinema of the Meaning and vice versa.
And it is a lot of thematic analysis, which is the best.
Which is great.
I don't know if it's a good way to make a podcast, but it's funny to me how quickly like it stopped being a podcast in my head and just like my time for talking with Tom about movies. So if nobody was listening, I think I'd still want to do it. I really enjoy the conversations we have. So it's fun to be able to share those with people.
Yeah. For sure. I think that's kind of what Beyond the Screenplay has become also. It's just like, let's hang out. Let's talk about movies, especially when we all go see a movie like Jurassic World Dominion and we need to debrief and vent or whatever the case may be. So let's dive into Gladiator. So I had not seen Gladiator. I had seen parts of it, but I'd never sat down and watched it like start to finish. When it came out, I think I was like 14 and wasn't allowed to like watch R-rated movies. But I remember hearing about it and like Russell Crowe's so great and all this stuff. But I also kind of assumed it was just going to be like violence and like hyper-masculinity and killing people, and didn't expect it to have this, which it has. But I wasn't expecting it to have this like rich story, and it's so well told and it's a beautiful, powerful, moving film that I was really like, I was sad that I hadn't seen it until recently because there's so many things in here that are really good. Weirdly, there were some like comparisons to Thelma and Louise that were happening in my brain since we just talked about Thelma and Louise as another Ridley Scott movie. But I really, really loved it. Trisha, I want to hear from you your thoughts, and then Thomas and Tom, let's hear why you guys want to talk about Gladiator. But yeah, Trisha, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I saw Gladiator back in the day. It would have not been in theaters. But I remember, you know, it's a long movie. It's like kind of the pinnacle of this period epic story that we had a few of those in the 90s, and they were like the big prestige award movies. And so this is like the big time. I don't know. Everybody saw Gladiator. Everybody loves Gladiator. It was nominated for 12 Oscars. It won 5 Oscars. It was just like the big movie. I like it. I think it's great. I want to get into the themes, and I'm so glad we have Thomas and Tom on to talk about the thematic stuff and the character arc and the journey. Because I think it's a little bit messy. And even though it's a very simple story, I feel like what's going on like a deeper level is sometimes gets a little muddy. And I think that in itself is interesting. For a story that's kind of simplistic and a character also that's a little simple with Maximus. And we don't have to get too much into the screenwriting, but the more that I've learned about the screenwriting, the more that it kind of illumines like what was happening, because the screenwriting process was also messy. I was watching it this time and the credits popped up and you can see the names of the writers on the screen, and there's like 4 of them or whatever. And you're like, oh, that's a few. And you get that sense, I think, when you watch it. But yeah, it's amazing performances. It's like this huge sweeping adventure with a huge sweeping adventure score by Hans Zimmer. And yeah, it's like there's kind of nothing better at this kind of movie than Gladiator, I think. So very excited to dive in more.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Tom, tell me about Gladiator.
I did saw Gladiator when I was really young, and so I've pretty much loved it ever since. I almost can't imagine having missed it, because it was just it was the go-to movie on television for the big movie night or movie Monday or whatever they had. But yeah, over the years, it's remained for me at least, a perfect integration of spectacle and action, and especially violent action, into a meaningful story. And there is some messiness there, but I think it works ultimately. But yeah, there's just a lot about the way the movie seems to comment on itself. And obviously with the gladiator fights, there's you have Maximus fighting in front of this audience, and there's also us as the audience of that audience and Maximus. So there is that kind of meta aspect to the whole movie. But I think it tackles it in a very interesting way, and also in a way that I just haven't seen a lot since. There's something about it that's extremely difficult to pull off, I think. And yeah, I look forward to get into that in more detail.
Yeah. No, yeah, absolutely. Cool. All right. And Thomas?
There's something about this kind of movie, and a lot of what I'm saying will probably overlap with what you guys have already said, but it's kind of a little bit of like a bygone icon of like a bygone era of filmmaking, not just in terms of subject matter, but in like the style of story and the fact that this was just like a screenplay that was commissioned by like DreamWorks. And then like they got Ridley Scott to make this, and it's like, this kind of movie doesn't really exist in this way anymore, it feels like. So it's interesting to watch that. Also, in terms of the approach to storytelling, weirdly, like this time watching it, I thought of RRR, which I just watched recently, which is like way more over the top than this. But watching this, having just seen RRR recently, which is a really, you know, very over the top Tollywood film, for those who aren't familiar with it, I was like feeling that just like the immense sincerity of this kind of story, with like, there's moments where, you know, there's just epic line, you know, it's like the whole movie is like, and now the hero is going to say this epic line, and you're just going to be like, yeah, it's like that kind of sincerity. Like, I feel like is rare these days. So it's interesting. Like, it feels like an artifact from a different era of filmmaking. So that on top of everything else that everybody else mentioned, and like Tom, I thought a lot about the like weird interplay of like, it's ultimately a story about entertainment, and it's a piece of entertainment. And that just adds this interesting, you know, film to everything. So yeah, very excited to discuss.
Yeah. Yeah, I was listening to your guys' episode about Top Gun Maverick, and I think you guys were identifying something that I was feeling also, just like you're saying, Thomas, this sincerity and just this genuine, non-cynical, we're just going to make a movie and go all the way and like be earnest about each moment. I was also feeling that in Gladiator and missing it and missing stories like this, and even the character arc, you know, it's very tragic, the, you know, him, Maximus, losing his family, but that's a huge motivator, and like, spoiler alert, he dies in the end. Like, we don't have stories that feel like they go to those extreme places anymore. It feels like you have to kind of play it a little bit safer, or if it's a Marvel movie, there's less, you know.
Well, because if the main character dies, Michael, how are you going to make 5 sequels? That's the real question, although there is some talk of Gladiator 2.
There was a really fascinating script for a sequel, apparently, a few years ago. It was called Christ Killer, and it's absolutely wild, apparently, but I highly doubt that's the one they're going to make.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would assume it would be a spiritual sequel and not a literal sequel.
Some people make it out of this movie that could be in a sequel to it.
Yeah,
fair. Yeah.
So the literal sequel they had, there was a the short story of it is that Maximus is sent to the afterlife, and then apparently all the gods live there and Jesus is among them. But then once the old Roman gods, they start to notice that Jesus is getting too popular back on Earth, they send Maximus to kill Jesus and his followers. And apparently it turns out into this really strange trickery of the gods thing, where Maximus ends up being turned into this eternal warrior. And apparently there was this long sequence with him fighting in every war that's ever happened since. And yeah, I can imagine it wasn't made. Yeah. But it's a fascinating story.
Yeah, that's more interesting than I would have expected. Yeah. So you have a great idea. Maybe it's for a narrative, maybe it's for a video essay, maybe it's a music video, it could be anything. The question then becomes, how do you visualize it? How do you communicate it to a collaborator and create buy-in? And how do you do all of that in a cost-effective way? Storyblocks is a royalty-free stock library that makes it possible for creators to keep up with the growing demands for modern video content, so you can bring all your stories to life and stop sacrificing your vision due to time, budget, or resources. Unlike traditional stock sites that limit content with a pay-per-clip model, Storyblocks gives you unlimited downloads, so you can create more. They have images and illustrations, audio and sound effects, and high-quality video and video templates. And Storyblocks has a selection of flexible subscriptions, so you can focus on creating instead of worrying about budget. To check out Storyblocks and sign up for their unlimited all-access plan, head to storyblocks.com/beyondthescreenplay. Once again, that's storyblocks.com/beyondthescreenplay. The link is also in the show notes. Thanks to Storyblocks for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Well, yeah, so why don't we kind of dive into the themes? It seems like there's a lot of thematic conversation that we're having. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so I'd be curious to even hear, like, from all of you guys, maybe starting with you, Trisha, like, yeah, what do we think the film is saying thematically? Because this is one of those movies where sometimes when a movie is too good, it's bad for the podcast, for me in the podcast, because I end up just like watching the movie and being engrossed in it and not thinking about it. So I haven't done a lot of like analysis of it and the thematic content. But as Tom and Thomas, you guys are bringing up, there is this kind of meta level of we're audience watching audience. It's about the power of the mob. They say that a lot. And like, you know, Rome is the mob and those kinds of things. So I'm curious, Trisha, what are some of the kind of thematic elements that you were picking up in this?
I mean, some of the most obvious have to do with like power, right? And the consolidation of power in one person and versus like the Republic, right? And so like, the idea is that the Senate, you know, Marcus Aurelius wants to return power to the Senate and to restore this dream that was Rome. And then Commodus is trying to hang on to power for selfish reasons, right? Because he feels impotent because his father never loved him and he's not that much of a man. He's not as much of a man as Maximus is, right? His sister always was in love with Maximus instead of him. And there's that conversation that's happening kind of in the larger overarching structure and story of it. I think that the theme that interests me the most is the one that you touched on earlier, Tom, about entertainment and where sort of like responsibility lies in entertainment of the entertainer and the relationship between them and the audience, right? There's the Colosseum is obviously sort of the most heightened, bloodthirsty, like, you know, worst of humanity, like our impulses to watch, you know, death and violence in the Colosseum. And I think I wish the movie interrogated that a little more. Right. It's really interesting. Oliver Reed's character, Proximo, who I love in this, he is the one who kind of speaks into that theme most, where he's like, if you win the audience, you're going to win your freedom. So you need to entertain them. You need to be an entertainer. And that's kind of actually his last like moment where he says, like, I'm an entertainer. Right. Mm-hmm. And I wish that there was kind of more of that in the movie. The audience in this is kind of faceless. And we see some push and pull where Commodus feels like he can't, you know, just have Maximus killed because of the power of the mob, as you're talking about. But where that falls with like our impulse as like spectators or voyeurs, I think is not as clear. And then none of that has anything to do with the revenge arc plot line, really, which is, you know, I think that Maximus is, like, journey is a like probably the weakest of all of these three themes, or it just kind of gets lost in the other ones where it's like he just wants to be with his family again, and he decides that he's going to fulfill the responsibility of serving Rome that Marcus Aurelius like asked him to do. That's kind of the big arc for him, but there isn't a lot of, it doesn't feel like there's a ton of internal work going on the character where he starts off with one clear thesis and then like swings to it. It doesn't feel like there's that traditional big arc hero's journey. Here's the way he sees the world. And then it goes under a total transformation. Not true for Maximus, which is not to say that, again, the movie isn't interesting, just that it's got a few different themes going on that kind of like don't always perfectly picture puzzle piece together. But we have two thematic experts sitting right here. Yeah. So
I was thinking, first of all, I think a lot of the issues with Proximo's character is that the actor, Oliver Reed, he passed away before they completed filming. So they had to rewrite some elements of the script to fit him in. Because I actually, it wasn't until today that I read that the fight that Maximus has against the veteran gladiator was supposed to be Proximo in an original script. So I'm not sure how that would have played out, but I think there would have been more of that interrogation maybe if they had been able to complete that original vision and not kind of cut it off halfway through. As to Maximus's journey, I actually really liked the way his personal story is the macro story as well. There's his personal vendetta kind of aligns with the quest that Rome as a whole is on to find some kind of justice. And I'm not sure he was supposed to have like I'm not sure it would have fitted if he had like a big transformation arc, because you can have like these static character arcs, because it's more the world around Maximus that changes and is changed eventually because of his presence. And that's something that I really like, the way he really starts at the lowest level as a slave, and then slowly he earns the respect of like the fellow gladiators, of the public, and eventually even of some of Commodus's lieutenants or generals, and the supposed enemies. And in that sense, it's actually his non-transformation that sets the world into motion, which I thought was really interesting. And I'm just personally a big fan of such character arcs where it's actually not the main character that changes, but the world around them. Kind of like Batman, maybe, or Hacksaw Ridge was an obvious example of that. I agree that it's the way he starts out with almost having like a death wish and then setting out on revenge and then only then setting out to fulfill Marcus Aurelius's final wish. That's a bit muddled as to when exactly he's motivated by which reason or motivation exactly. So, but yeah.
I think Marcus or Maximus's character arc is strength and point A, strength and honor. Point B, point C, strength and honor. It's like,
yep.
Yeah. Yeah, it is this kind of like interesting, as you're saying, Tom, it's a very flat character arc where he is changing the world and changing the minds. I think to your point, Trisha, it's interesting that there are, like, the way he's doing that is through entertainment, as we've said, and like through the mob. And it feels like there are moments when the movie has an opinion on, like, is that good or bad? And there are moments where Maximus, you know, when the idea is kind of first, like, suggested to him of, like, win the crowd and blah, 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 that it seems like he's disinterested or kind of maybe even disgusted by the idea. I don't know. It's very subtle, so that might be projecting there. But it is interesting, kind of like you were just saying, that, like, there's, and any given moment, his motivations aren't always crystal clear, and how he feels about having to perform basically to sway the mob to do what needs to be done. Yeah, it's just interesting in that it isn't really interrogated, like you're saying, too much in the film.
Yeah, I mean, an obvious and bad way to do it, I think, would be to start off, you know, having Maximus go like, I hate gladiators. I think it's bloodthirsty and wrong. And, like, I think it's the worst thing about Rome and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and then have to go through the process of, like, maybe there is something here, but maybe whatever. No one wants that. And so, you know, my observation that the themes aren't super in clear conversation with each other is not necessarily a critique. I just want to clear that up. And I do think it makes it, sort of the diffuse, like, nature of these different themes playing together makes those couple moments you pointed out just now, Michael, when they do come into, like, super sharp focus, you know, those moments really sing. And I think that's part of the reason that some of those moments are the most iconic in it, right? Obviously, the most famous one in it is Are You Not Entertained? And that's all of those different things kind of coming together. And so I think that under the circumstances, you're trying to tell this huge story, and there are really interesting themes in it. And the plot itself is so compelling, and the action itself is so riveting, and, like, everything about it, so well shot, the filmmaking, Russell Crowe's performance, that, like, you only need a few of those little things to feel like you're being told a story that has, like, crystal clear themes and depth. And there's enough in it that I think it can be mined in the way that we're doing now for the where these things pop up.
I think that's a great point, because where the movie really sings for me is that all this stuff, a lot of what we've been talking about so far, is kind of like the setup that sets these really high stakes for these moments where then it's like the actual conflict of the movie is almost always being resolved within, like, these fights that are set up. And so there's this relationship where you have conflict between these two characters that are both drawing their power from, like, their ability to entertain, and they're in conflict, but they need the mob on their side. Like, even Maximus being set up as this, like, incredible warrior, like, at the end, his success is more in, like, the fact that the soldiers surrounding him kind of get on his side, and they're like, they don't give a sword to the
Commodus.
Yes, yeah. Commodus. And it's like you can kind of read through that, like, he would have lost if he hadn't, like, won those guys to his side. So it's not really his individual strength that ultimately, like, wins him. It's the fact that these people have decided to side with him. So we see that conflict set up in all these scenes. And then where it actually plays out is like in the combat, which I think it sets up this very nice mirror where like we're experiencing the stakes that like the audience would be experiencing as we're watching it. And we're like, what's going to happen? Who's going to win? And that like that to me hits on where it operates really well as like a movie, because you get to like see the conflict play out instead of just like, you know, that it's being resolved through exposition or somebody saying something somewhere.
Yeah.
It also adds so much significance to the way the action is performed and the way the violence is kind of displayed, because that's something that I feel is missing from a lot of action movies. I think most movies understand that when you have an action scene, it needs to result in some sort of change, but that usually only means like a change in the plot, like some character will have an object, there'll be a chase scene and they'll lose the object or something like that. But I feel what makes Gladiator so fascinating is that it's not just the outcome of an action scene that matters, but also the way it is performed, because that's something they set up quite early on when Maximus goes in for the first time. He kind of kills them all, kills all the enemies sort of unceremoniously. And then they're like, no, you don't, that's not the right way to do it. You have to, there needs to be a performative element to that, which also kind of plays out in the way the movie depicts its own violence. And in that way, to me at least, makes it a lot more meaningful than just watching a action scene waiting for it to play out and see what kind of outcome is achieved.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We used some clips from Gladiator when we were doing a video about like a final battle and like the construction of a battle scene in screenwriting. And I was thinking a lot about that because we talked a lot about like containment and boundaries and stakes, right? And so like to create a compelling battle, you have to have really clear boundaries to the battlefield and clear rules that the characters have to follow. And, you know, we used that kind of rule or those ideas to talk about the final like courtroom scene in A Few Good Men. We were drawing parallels between this and that, which is a totally different kind of battle, right? But Gladiator is one of the best ever because the fights are super contained. There are really clear boundaries and rules, and it's to the death, basically, every time. So the stakes couldn't possibly be higher. And so it's just an amazing construction for drama because as a screenwriter, all you're trying to do is the work that's basically done for you in Gladiator in the easiest way possible. And so it's just, you know, Gladiator just does it. It's like, lock them together. The stakes are high. Here you go. And then you can just focus, as you're pointing out, Tom, on the nature of how the battle unfolds. And it's always going to be compelling. Like, that's mm-hmm. all we need for it to be compelling.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think So yeah, as you're saying, Tricia, like the stakes are clear, the boundaries are there, the rules are set. And then like you're saying, Tom, that so much of the focus is on the how the battle plays out. And like you were saying, Thomas, there's like the antagonist and the protagonist are fighting kind of indirectly via the crowd, right? Like they're using, it's all mm-hmm. about who can perform and manipulate the crowd. And that's what gives them that power. And so it is all focused down, like all those things collapse onto each battle such that each battle is full of meaning and exciting and compelling, not just because it's swords and action, but because of every moment that happens, you know, will have a consequence. And I think that's all these things are really identifying why these battle scenes are super compelling in a way that your average action movie or a different kind of, you know, swords and sandals fight might be cool to look at, but doesn't have the emotional grip that each fight has in Gladiator.
Yeah. I think also the way we tend to talk about action nowadays is very divorced from what the actual story needs. Like when you ask someone on YouTube, for example, like what's a good action scene, they'll talk about wide angles. Now everything has to be clear. It has to be like not shaky. But Gladiator actually doesn't really abide by those rules. It has a much more visceral depiction of violence, which I think fits better to serve this particular story. But when you compare it to 300, for example, or especially the 300 sequel, which has that really stylized violence without really having a story reason for that violence to be so stylized. So that's something I thought was really interesting too about Gladiator. It's not trying to depict the violence in the most pretty way, but it's trying to go for that ultimate emotional response. You can see that, I think, the clearest in the, I think it was called the Battle of Carthage, the middle, the big centerpiece before the midpoint, where Maximus is fighting in the Colosseum with his buddies against the bad guys on the chariots, so to say. And there's just so many layers of, for one, having them play out a battle scene that they're supposed to lose. So on that level, there's already that subversion of history that's happening through their own like cooperation and their Maximus reclaiming his role as a leader again. And just the way it's performed it, with the music, it's like really triumphant when Maximus wins that one. And at the end, he does his big performative, like, we won. And it's a clear difference from also from the way he started out as a gladiator. And it's more comparable to the way he did his initial battle scene, in which that feeling of brotherhood was more naturally expressed. But here, you can argue to what extent it is performative or to what extent he's genuinely cheering, like, for having achieved an almost impossible victory. And I just love the way the action is performed in this movie.
Yeah.
One thing I think you just touched on there, Tom, that I forgot to mention completely when I was talking about themes, that I think is one of the most interesting ones in here, is the theme of leadership and what leadership looks like, right? And in this particular case, it's very like, you know, war, you know, sort of martial, masculine leadership. But I think the movie is hugely about that. Although it's not often addressed in like the dialogue of the characters, other than like people saluting Maximus all the time, because no one can help but salute him. He's such a leader.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is a really big part of the conversation about, you know, it's about succession in the sense of who is going to be the leader of Rome. You know, there's that, I mentioned the theme of power that's in there, but I think the theme of leadership is even a more interesting one. And I wish, I'd love to hear what you guys think about it, because where it pops up, the first battle in Germania is the one where it's like, he is the leader. They will follow him anywhere. They will follow him to the death for sure. And the way that he talks to his men there. And then it gets all the way, you know, we see, he wants to be no one. He wants to be nothing. He scrapes the tattoo off. He cuts the tattoo off of his shoulder. He doesn't want to be a leader. And isn't it, Lucilla, she says, you know, he's like, I absolutely don't want to do this. And she's like, that's why you have to be the one to do it, right? There's this idea that this sort of humble leader who doesn't want to be a leader is going to be the best leader, all the way through to all the other gladiators will like die for him. In the courtyard when the Praetorian guards come. So very curious to hear your guys' thoughts on that.
I definitely have a lot of thoughts on that.
You can go first, Tom.
Yes. I think what this movie really does quite well is connect the issue of leadership to the issue of vision and a collective vision that a leader presents to a society, and the way maybe a leader gives shape to what is seen by the people as their collective identity. And I think that there might be a bit of a contradiction there at the end, but I think the way it is set up especially is, I love the way after the first gladiator fight where Maximus is first introduced to the arena, and then the moment the battle is over, he really starts to notice the crowd for the first time, and you get that really Michael Bay-ish shot where the camera pans around them real fast, and then it transitions into this scene where Commodus enters back into Rome, and it is this really like this big music, big visuals, and it, but to me it actually invoked a kind of triumph of the will kind of spectacle, the Hitler propaganda film, in which there's these huge buildings, these huge monuments, and Garmond is riding in victoriously. And I think at that point, the movie really communicates kind of the dangers of spectacle in this, in the way it can be this thing of grandeur and grandiosity and just violence for entertainment, with which later comes with the Gladiator games. But I think the challenge of the movie was then to have to kind of subvert the idea that this kind of spectacle is bad, while also still portraying a movie that has that kind of spectacle, just in the sense that it's entertaining. And so the way it kind of does that, I think, is that it has Maximus kind of reappropriating the spectacle into a more democratic, it wasn't exactly a democracy, but a more liberating ideal, I think, instead of a tyrannical one. So I think that's kind of what the movie tries to suggest, maybe, that it's not spectacle as oppression and sedation, but more spectacle as a sense of defiance and revolution that ultimately is what kind of stokes the fire to bring down Commodus and restore Rome to that original vision that's more more about the people, more about the Senate, more about the boring work of having a society that actually provides services and security and things to its people, instead of just deludes them with these illusions of grandeur and spectacle and that sort of stuff.
Mm. Yeah. All of which I was disturbed by how relevant it felt. Also, this idea of leaders that are great at putting on a show and maybe not great at leading.
So actually leading.
Yeah.
Tom summarized that so well. I don't know how much I could add, but yeah, I'm totally on the same page with you, Michael, where watching this, I was like, just the feeling the weight of that connection between leadership and entertainment, and how, like, there's, in a sense, like, we don't want it to be like, I've been thinking about what this movie is saying in regards to this. Because to me, it doesn't feel like it has like this clear like thesis of, I mean, I think Tom is making a good point towards like showcasing Maximus as more of a spirit of like rebellion and revolt. Like he's pushing directly back against the emperor. Although like there's some sense in which like, I think this is where maybe to your point, Tricia, it gets a little messy in that like, the theme of revenge there kind of like muddies like what's going on with his character and like what he's trying to accomplish and why. So yeah, I have trouble like feeling out like, does this movie have a thesis about like, what does entertainment mean within this context of leadership and that kind of stuff. And I don't know that there's a clear one that I could get a handle on by the end of the film of like, oh yes, you know, we have to be careful about this. But just seeing it depicted in this way, I think it's in such a different context from our own. I think it's just a good, way of entering into like feeling that relationship of like, oh yes, our ability to get caught up in something or be entertained, or entertainment, the way entertainment like increases scope like of someone's actions or someone's behavior. Like if you can do something and like a few people see it on a battlefield, it's like, okay, you've influenced like the people directly around you. But then if you do it in a stadium and like all these thousands of people see you, then suddenly you have a cultural movement or something. And so, you know, even you and maybe Tom, you disagree, or maybe you disagree that there is a thesis here by the end. I couldn't really find that, but I think even just entering into that space of feeling that relationship and having that reminder of like, these things are kind of difficult to pull apart, like leadership and entertainment. And we don't really want it to, like, we can be like, that's not good. That's not how it should be. but like, it's not easy to separate those. We can't just be like, well, it's not good, so that's not how it is. It's like, you know, and then you're watching this and you're like, oh, it's cool because they're fighting and they're gladiators. And so then you're getting caught up in it too. And you're like, you know, I don't know. It's like very difficult to untangle.
Yeah. That's actually why I like that the movie doesn't have a resolution that goes like, oh no, spectacle is bad and we shouldn't do it ever. And at the same time, still present a very spectacular
while
movie.
Still being a movie though, yeah.
Exactly. So I like that it's honest enough to know that spectacle and entertainment and all that stuff is a part of our society, however you play it out. So I like that it tries to find some resolution within the boundaries instead of have this really obvious moralistic message at the end that is hard to apply to an actual real life situation. But yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah, and I think kind of like to your point, Thomas, and kind of what everyone's been saying, that this movie raises these ideas, makes you think about it, presents it in a context that is, you know, not our lives and not about us. And so you can engage with it a bit more. And that's why I think that thematic element of leadership and performance kind of snuck up on me. We're halfway through, I was like, oh, this is extremely relevant. Like, nothing about the details of what's happening here is, but like this idea of, the performance and what you said earlier, Tom, I thought was really great. This like spectacle and performance as like a leadership tool to create an identity of a people. Like, there's so much power in that. And you see that happening in this, and that Maximus is like using spectacle in a more positive way, I guess, right? Where like for a while he's like Maximus the Merciful because he doesn't kill the person. Like, he's defying these things and breaking the rules, but within this specific context. So that's where, yeah, these ideas of like rebellion and all that stuff comes from. But it's showing how you can use this power to create a different identity, right? Like a different dream for Rome than what Commodus is using it for.
And specifically also the tools of oppression, because the irony is that if Commodus hadn't held these gladiator games, then Maximus would still be on the outskirts of in Africa somewhere, and he would not have been able to rise through the ranks, so to say, and overcome Commodus at the end. So that there's a bit of irony there. I'm not sure what to make of that, but just thought it was interesting to point out.
Yeah.
One thing that I think is kind of driving all of this or is just happening under the surface, all of this that I think is super smart screenwriting also is the fact that Maximus has nothing to lose. And he like it, you know, the choice to take away his entire family is super dark. I was like, oh yeah, they're just gonna kill that very small child from Life is Beautiful. like he made it out of a concentration camp and you're just gonna, okay. Anyway, but that choice at the beginning to really take everything away from him, his farm, he loves his wheat so much. His harvest is always ready.
So many hands through the wheat.
Yeah. Just gonna touch the earth and all the plants. But by stripping the character, like everything away that the character might care about, it allows him to be a tool to be used by the movie, like in a way that, you know, abandons. We talked about his motivations being muddy. They are. But it abandons sort of the need for like, we need to know in every scene what his motivation is. We don't. He's got nothing to lose and people are trying to kill him constantly. So it just kind of makes him into this like blunt instrument that he can just kind of bash his way through this movie and drive the plot forward in a way that we can just enjoy watching. And that's not to say, sorry, that makes it sound like as that disregards all of the elegantly put together thematic work that we're kind of discussing. But from a character design standpoint, it's just a smart way to go, because we don't need to be able to parse, like, why is he not trying to save his own life in this scene? Like, why isn't he more cautious? Why isn't he worried about what his performance is saying to the people? We don't have to wonder any of that, because he's just a man with nothing to lose. And so, like, except, and all he wants is to kill Commodus. Maybe he does want more than that, but boil it down and there's enough to drive him through every single scene. And you can pick what you think his motivation is at any given moment, but you don't need to know it exactly or be able to put a fine point on it.
I agree with you, Trisha, that I think, like, we're talking about deeper themes here. And I think those things are, like, in the movie enough that it's very interesting to talk about them. And it has some interesting things to illustrate and say, but I would say, like, to your point, why the movie works as, like, a movie, an entertaining movie, is much more basic than that. It's, like, not because it's a commentary on entertainment and leadership. Like, it works because it sets up these characters, it kind of puts them on a path, there's conflict, and you get to watch it. I was thinking about how, like, there you spend a good, like, 45 minutes of setup in this movie that really sets the characters on a path. And then, you know, these guys are going to come head to head again, and we're going to have to resolve this somehow. And it really takes its time in getting to that place. But because it does that setup, and because you kind of know the inevitability of, like, what needs to happen, you feel that conflict, and like, at its core, it's operating in a much more basic way.
For sure. I noticed this time around that one little scene in Germania where Commodus is fighting with his trainers, and how much setup work that is doing. Like,
Chekhov's
Commodus sword fight.
Yeah.
And just how much basic screenwriting work that is doing, because we are never going to see Commodus. All we're going to do is see him sitting around in palaces, scheming, walking around, being creepy at everybody, and just be constantly being worried about what's going on that he doesn't know about. But we're never going to see him fighting. But if you need to have him fighting Maximus at the end, we have to have that scene. And I do wonder, when I saw it this time, I was like, it really waves a banner for me right now of, like, here we are. Commodus also can swing a sword. Right. Notice it. But effectively, right? So by the time Commodus gets in the ring with Maximus, you're like, oh, he also can wave a sword. I saw him do it.
Yeah.
I think that training scene also sets up his character so well, as someone who has this extensive training scene right after the battle. And he's set up as this person who knows of combat but does not participate in it. And so he's always kind of on the outside, and he doesn't have that direct experience that Maximus has, who's all bloodied and beaten, whereas Commodus is perfectly clean. You see, even see him shirtless, like, to even further emphasize he has no bruises whatsoever. He's just unscathed completely. And I think that's it's such a telling moment about who he is as a person, and the kind of character that he is, and where he takes his pride and his self-confidence from, even though he doesn't really have anything, or he didn't do anything to really earn that.
He has other virtues, Tom.
That's true. Yes,
like ambition.
Yeah, that's
everyone's favorite virtue. Well, so why don't we move into lessons? Because there's tons of stuff to talk about. But yeah, we can move into the context of, like, so what lessons are we going to take away from Gladiator? And maybe I'll start, actually, because Thomas, what you brought up there, the very long act one. I've realized that I really like movies that have a long act one if they use it properly. And I think structurally this movie, like, start to finish is really great and really strong. But the act one, like you're saying, sets up these characters, sets up, like, desires, obstacles, fears, all those things, points them in a direction, and then, like we're off. We get it by the end of that first act. And I was thinking about how why that first act is so compelling, and it was tying into one of the first thoughts I was having while watching this was like, oh, Game of Thrones saw this movie. Like, there's some of that yeah. in this. Where just like, you know, the politics of the brother and succession, and then the sister is very Cersei-like in a way of like, if you had been a man, you could have been a great ruler, but that sucks that we have these rules, and so now you're trapped and tortured, kind of. But there's so much, you know, we start with this epic battle, but there's so much scheming and characterization, like we're talking about, to understand that wherever this act one is headed, it's not going to be good, right? There's a sense of like ominousness that's there, and the political maneuvering is so compelling because you know it's going to go bad at some point. So I just really liked the design of that first act because it does all these things, like you're saying, Trisha, like is backstory. We got it. No kids, nothing to lose. Back against the wall. Like everything we need to know for the rest of the movie is set up there. And then I also just want to call out the midpoint because, you know, I've heard the the Maximus, you know, speech of like, I am Maximus Decimus, blah, 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 husband to a murdered uncle or, you know, whatever. And so I'd heard it so many times that I was like, okay, great. But when you feel it, when like he takes off the mask and he reveals and like suddenly everything that's been happening in the first half up to the moment, like it's such a great moment. And I was like, oh man, that is a good midpoint. So I like to nerd out about midpoints, and that was, I get why people like that speech now because it's very, very powerful.
It's the midpoint.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thomas, what lesson are you going to take away from Gladiator?
The big lesson I think I took away here is something I touched on a little bit earlier, but just the way in which, like, and you kind of mentioned this a little bit as well, Michael, but the way in which the each kind of piece of this movie, there's two parts, basically, the action and then, like, political, you know, interpersonal scheming and all of this stuff. And each of those parts really like informs and improves the other in that like all the political context is not just like weird extra stuff to kill time. It like always is raising the stakes of what's happening within the action. And then the presence of the action or the impending action / combat that's coming kind of serves as this, like it's the bomb under the table that of all those scenes that you like, you know, even that whole first act, you would maybe just kind of be like, what's going on if this movie was called like a Roman soldier or something, but it's like, it's Gladiator. So you, that whole first 45 minutes, you know, like a gladiator is coming at some point to like, and there's going to be fights. And so you have this very effective interplay between those two things where neither element gets boring, even though like, even though some of the combat in here, like, in my opinion, if you were just looking at it in like a technical formal way, like there's much more interesting ways of staging like an action scene. But because the stakes are high and the combat is what's fulfilling or like where those stakes are being resolved, we're entertained by it. And then, you know, those are the moments that kind of like create the suspense that allow us to not get bored by, you know, the exposition about the Senate or something like that.
Yeah. And it's simple, but necessary to do in a movie like this, where you can't vary the kind of action sequence you're going to have, really, right? Like, it's going to be a hand-to-hand fight. It's not going to be a gunfight. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a car chase. It's not going to be any of those things. It's going to be a hand-to-hand fight with swords. But so when you have that constraint as a screenwriter, the simplest thing that you have to do is just create variation, right? So every fight has to be distinct in some way. And they do a really good job of that here, where it's like, now we're going to reenact this battle and there's chariots. Now we got to fight this guy and there's tigers. Now there's this thing. And it just works really well to keep each one distinct in your mind. It's like, that's when Maximus was fighting them. That's that one. Again, simple, but very well done given the constraints.
Yeah.
And it's something we don't always like. There's a lot of action movies now where it's like John Wick is cool to watch because he's going to look cool doing the action. Like that's the whole like that's what sells that those films or something like that. And I feel like that's kind of been the trend more recently. But there's a whole nother piece of cinema where it's like you know, in a Western, you can have two guys just, there's only one gunshot. You have two guys stand there for like 5 minutes, and then it can be the most intense thing ever because like you've had 45 minutes of setup for that and you know it's coming the entire time. So it creates both suspense and then like a really intense climax when those things do come. So yeah, I think this movie is a great illustration of that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like if you can infuse meaning to the actions such that a simple action can be the most compelling thing ever. And that's, I guess it's hard to do, but it's frustrating that the lesson that is often learned is the...
Make it mean something.
Make it meaningful. Yeah, right. That's my lesson.
That's the best lesson. Another thought I was having just there, if you guys weren't here for this, but Trisha and the Thelma and Louise episode, again, Ridley Scott, I'm seeing so many parallels with Thelma and Louise and Gladiator. But basically, you talked about how in Thelma and Louise, there was this kind of structure of you see them in the car, they're talking about things, updating us essentially on like how they're feeling about like where they are in their character journey. And then they stop somewhere and then something happens. But each time they stop somewhere, it has meaning because we've just had a car scene where they've like told us where they are in their journey and what they're wanting. And then after the thing happens and you rob the bank, well, now we're in a new car scene. And so there was a similar structure here happening with the Gladiator fights and kind of what you're saying, Thomas, of this, like you have the fight that is a point of action. It has meaning. It changes the things outside of the Gladiator ring. Those things have meaning and up the stakes and then change the meaning for the next. And they just keeps this like back and forth cadence that I think is really powerful and good. Yeah. Tom, I'm going to save you for last. So Trisha, what's your lesson?
Sure. I was thinking about Commodus and Joaquin Phoenix's performance is awesome in this. Commodus is one of these villains, though, that kind of sticks with you. And I was thinking about the design and the character. And we touched on some of it already about just like his feelings of insecurity and like feeling like, you know, he's not good enough. And I think that the relationship between him and his father is, you know, really critical to this because his desire for his father to like love him and be proud of him is not a bad desire. You know, it's a really simple construction for a villain to say like, make them want a thing that's actually good, but make them want it too much. And that's what this is, right? It's a really basic thing that everybody wants. We all want a parent to be proud of us. We all want a parent to love us and live up to the legacy of whatever that they wanted us to be. And when you take that to the most extreme point, you get this perversion of it and this like distorted vision of yourself and this insecurity that we see in Commodus. And so I think it's really, I just think it makes him memorable and like in a way sympathetic and interesting because his desire is not like power, power, rule Rome, everyone bow down to me. That's not as relatable as like, I wish my dad had loved me. And so his desire is sympathetic, but obviously twisted. But the virtues that I was joking about earlier where he's like, but I'm good at other things. I mean, the movie shows us that, right? Like he actually is kind of good at other things. He can read people. He's pretty smart about stuff. And he needs to be kind of a dangerous villain. Otherwise, we won't care if Maximus defeats him or not. He needs to be dangerous. We need to see that he's a danger to Rome. And so the scheming that we see going on when he's just like worried about the Senate and, you know, trying to manipulate the people around him, that in itself, it's important for him to not be like a bumbling idiot. He has to be good at things. So he has to want something that's relatable and understandable. And he also has to have some skills and talents and virtues of his own in order to be a compelling villain. And so he has both of those things. And then you have this killer performance by Joaquin Phoenix. And I'm scared. Like, and also he needs to die. So by the end of it, I'm totally with you.
Right. It's definitely one of, like, I usually am not happy when anyone dies in a movie because, you know, life is precious and all that stuff. But, like, watching him die was like, yes,
yeah,
kill him. yeah, it was very satisfying.
Well, and really critically, he doesn't win that fight fair, right? And he doesn't win it at all.
Right.
But he doesn't play that fight fair. If he had, like, if it had even been closer to a fair fight, first of all, Maximus would have destroyed him instantly. So there's a practical thing going on there where he stabs him in the lung. But if he had fought fair, I think that just that final treachery of, like, I'm doing it for show, right? But it's not real. It's that entertainment piece again, but it isn't the reality of what's actually happening. I think also it's just like, he's got to die. It just makes, just to your point, it makes it that much sweeter when the treachery, someone who is false and dishonest and cowardly meets their end.
Yeah. Yeah, that's also what I like about him a lot. Like, you, as you said, Trisha, there's a certain sympathy to his character in the sense that you can relate to his initial motivation. But I also like that they didn't go, as they do a lot nowadays, with the I'm misunderstood and I actually have good motivations, but I take it too far and now I'm killing innocents. You know, that kind of villainous direction.
Yep.
But I like that, that Commodus has some genuinely bad character traits as well that also make him really unpredictable and actually dangerous in the perception of others, that he's not just a misunderstood little boy at heart who wants his daddy's approval, but he also is genuinely like maybe prideful or delusional in, or like grandiose. And he just has some genuinely bad traits that also define his characters and that add to his the complexity, I think, of his of him as a villain, which I agree that he's one of the more memorable villains in any movie, basically. So it's just a great character all around.
The scene where he's got his arm around his nephew and he's telling that little story, which is so clearly not about what he says it's about, but he's telling that little story to his sister about the treachery among people and antiquity or whatever against an emperor, is it, that scene needs to be horrifying and tense. Like, we need to understand the stakes. Would he kill his own nephew? Yes, he definitely would kill his own nephew. So again, going back to your point, Tom, he has to actually be dangerous and have genuinely like, what's the word I'm looking for?
I think dangerous is a good way to
I was going to say menace, misanthropy or something like that, but he's
vicious, maybe.
Yeah. Ruthless.
Yeah.
He needs to be genuinely ruthless. And we need to absolutely buy that, that he would hurt people that he even really cares about just to get what he wants.
Yeah.
You really feel the tension in those moments where he's like wavering on the edge of like, you know, I could just kill Maximus right now, but like he's swayed by the crowd. You really feel it's not like every time that happens, because there's kind of like multiple moments every time I'm like genuinely scared that he might just go through with it, and like, you know, that can't really happen yet at those points because it's a lot of movie left, but like I think his danger and that threat is in the character is a big part of what sells the tension of those moments.
Well, that three-dimensionality that you know, you guys are all talking about here, where you understand what he's thinking in those moments, right? He's not just like pausing and you're like, just like throw your thumb up or down. But like, you understand all the things and the scheming that's happening. And Joaquin Phoenix's performance is really good. I understand why people were like, he's a good actor after this movie. Awesome. Okay, Tom, what's your lesson?
Yeah, I think my main lesson from Gladiator is one that we've talked about a lot right now, or by now. It's just the way it includes action and spectacle in a way that also makes the performative element of it matter, and just the way it is communicated and not just as a tool to reach a certain outcome in an exciting way. I can't really think of any movies that do it quite this well. There's probably some others, but I think Gladiator has always been my go-to example to discuss or study meaningful spectacle and meaningful action, meaningful violence, and just the way you can make all those elements matter on multiple different levels of a story.
Yeah, the Hunger Games borrows a lot thematically from Gladiator, obviously, and other stories like this. And the book is about, is more about this kind of theme that we've been talking about of like the performative aspects of leadership and combat specifically, and like what that, what violence as entertainment means. So anyway, not as, not quite as historical is what I'm going to go with.
Well, maybe as historical as this movie, based on what I was reading about.
Fair point.
But yeah, to Tom, to your point, there's a lot of little like details in like that set piece where we talked about already, where they're redoing the battle and it turns in their favor. Like there's those little bits where Maximus is like, we need to stay together. And the movie doesn't like make a huge deal out of it, but like he says that and some of the people stay together and some of them don't. And then we just see like all the ones who don't die. And it's like, it's like that little piece, which is like a subplot of this larger piece of action, just kind of helps communicate and reinforce like, oh, Maximus kind of like knows what he's doing, and like what he says makes a difference, and it is that which makes them, you know, able to succeed. But it's just like, you know, embedded in there within the action in a way that it's not like drawing a huge arrow pointing to it, but it just plays out as part of the scene.
I also love that little moment. It's right at the beginning of that battle where Maximus asks if anyone has served in the army before, and then someone off screen mentions quite subtly like, oh yeah, I've served under you in that place. And you don't even see who it is, and it's not really brought up again, but I don't know why I thought that was just such an interesting little detail, but...
Yeah. Mm. Well, yeah, there's also just so much like texture in the world, and like you really believe in this story world that has been created, and yeah, little details like that can go a long way to that. And
yeah. I think Ridley Scott in general is so good at that kind of world building and inserting all these little almost throwaway lines and little details that seem unnecessary, but do end up building to the overall immersive aspect of it all. It's just really fascinating to me.
The little motif of like Maximus like grabbing the dirt and just like rubbing it around. It's little things like that that are like so simple, but add to the physicality of the world in a way that like... I mean, it's almost iconic to the point of parody, the like hand in the wheat kind of shot. But like there's something about that that is almost like archetypal in a sense where like it's just lodged straight into my brain the first time I saw it. And you see it crop up like everywhere. But it has that sort of like, I don't know, there's a physicality to the world that connects you to the character and his experience.
I hate that motif. Like I've seen it in so many movies of like hands through grain, and I'm like, how great can your hand rubbing over grain be? Like everyone, like it's got to be a handheld shot from a low angle, and the sunset is this flaring lens. Mm-hmm. But in this movie, I was like, oh, like I get it, and there's meaning to it ascribed to it within this movie, and it's also kind of helping to set up this kind of afterlife thread that is throughout that also makes his death and the end feel like a victory. Hashtag Thelma and Louise similarities. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert. So yeah, it felt earned in this movie.
It sets up so much with just those two opening shots. You open with the hand in the wheat and it's warm and it feels homely, and then immediately we cut to Maximus standing in the snow in the cold, and it's more bluish, the screen, and just in those two shots there's already so much that's being communicated about what he wants, where he's from, and where he is now, and what he's looking back to. And I agree, it's a tired trope at this point, but it does work quite well here. I think I'm not sure if Gladiator was actually the first to do it, or if it's been...
it might be a tired trope because of this movie, I think.
Well, and just really quickly thinking about the tactile, like the texture of the world, it's also a big part of it is the sound design, I think. Like it just really transports you there. That battle in Germania where you can hear like the horses and the armor clashing and the swords. And I just feel like there's so much. This was nominated for an Oscar. I don't know if it won.
I think it won for best sound.
Sound mixing. Yeah, it should have, because it just does so much where you feel like the metal and the earth and the everything just coming together. It feels like crunchy in the way that Alex would say if he were here.
Yes.
Not bouncy. No bounce detected.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. I mean, yeah, so there's, I think we could talk for a very long time about all the things that Gladiator does, because it really is great. I'm, as I said, very happy that I've been forced to finally close out this hole in my filmography. And kind of like you were saying, Tom, I think it's one I will return to frequently to study lots of different things. The structural, like you're saying, that the action and how to infuse it with meaning. Yeah, all these things we've talked about are good movie. Thumbs up. Thumbs up for Michael. I could feel the tension there too. That was, yeah. Cool. So before we wrap up, why don't we quickly go around and say what we're watching and what we might recommend to people. I'm going to do it in reverse order. So Tom, why don't you start us off?
It's been a while, but on the topic of Ridley Scott, a while ago, Thomas and I revisited Kingdom of Heaven. And in particular, the director's cut, which I think is a wildly different movie from the one that released in theaters back when it came out. And yeah, I think that's I wouldn't say it's better than Gladiator. Definitely not. Probably on all the technical levels, Gladiator still wins. But for some reason, I might like Kingdom of Heaven more. It's one that if you'd ask me on any day, like which one do you want to watch? Like, I might lean towards Kingdom of Heaven because it feels slightly more adventurous in some way. And whereas Gladiator is more like this Shakespearean tragedy that feels a bit more heavy-handed at times. But yeah, Kingdom of Heaven, that's one for me that I think is really underappreciated, both in the context of Ridley Scott's filmography as well as in film history in general, which... Yeah, there's so many interesting themes on religion and morality, and especially the kind of personal principles versus a more altruistic collective goal. And typical for Ridley Scott, there's great world building, great music, great sounds and textures. And so, yeah, that's one it's my go-to recommendation for movies for people who... because it's also one that, in my experience, at least a lot of people have missed, even though they like movies like Gladiator and the big swords and sandals stuff. For some reason, a lot of them haven't seen Kingdom of Heaven or only saw the theatrical cuts. But if you're someone like that, I definitely recommend check out the director's cut as well. It's to me, it's an amazing movie.
Yeah, I had never seen it, so I'm one of those people, and was just looking up in the cast, even as like so Orlando Bloom, Ava Green, Liam Neeson, Michael Sheen, David Thewlis. Like, that's an impressive lineup. Lots of other people too. So, all right,
that's definitely some great performances in there.
Nice, awesome. All right, cool. Trisha, what about you? What have you been watching?
Yeah, so I decided to watch this movie from 1990 called Bad Influence, which is a Rob Lowe and James Spader thriller, I'm going to go with.
That is a
directed by Curtis Hanson and written by David Koepp. First of all, love David Koepp. Just what a... I could talk for ages about David Koepp and the literally 50 movies that he's written. I like counted it the other day and I was like, oh, you've written 50 movies and some of the greatest of all times. And then some of the others that are just like, I didn't know you made this. And Bad Influence is one of those, but it's about, you know, Rob Lowe plays this like sort of nameless, charming guy who kind of lives on the fringes and is like a pickup artist and like just kind of lives fast and loose. And James Spader plays this really buttoned up corporate dude. And it kind of becomes, you know, this like influential, like masculine sort of Rob Lowe constantly challenging James Spader to just like act out and be more of a man and take control of his life. If it sounds like Fight Club, it is very, very much like Fight Club. It is very interesting. Anyway, really, really liked it. It's got some super messed up kind of haunting set pieces in it. And it's just this like, yeah, kind of thriller, psychological thriller from 1990. So if you are interested more in like violence and masculinity and what that means, definitely Bad Influence is one to check out. And I had never even heard of it before I decided to check it out.
Interesting. I feel like Bad Influence could be the name of Fight Club. That would actually be a totally fine title swap.
Well, like, so there isn't the kind of twist that you get in Fight Club, but there are some jaw-dropping revelations. So I don't know. Like, I didn't really know where it was going. It takes some very extreme twists and turns that I really... The thing about David Koepp's movies is just like, stuff happens. Lots of stuff happens, and it's usually real cinematic, and he just really goes for it all the time in a way that I can't help but appreciate. So, yeah. Bad Influence.
Nice. Cool. All right, Thomas, what about you?
I am very into, this is going in a completely different direction from the other two recommendations, but I'm very into Nathan Fielder's The Rehearsal right now. Nathan Fielder is back on HBO, and he's concocted a new incredible world where he gets these people who have some kind of situation in their life. The pilot is about a guy who has been lying about the fact that he has a master's degree when he only has a bachelor's, and he's too afraid to tell his trivia friends. And so to help him work through this situation, Nathan Fielder recreates the bar where he goes to trivia, hires all these extras, and they tirelessly rehearse every aspect of how this situation will go down where he confesses. And then they like actually film the confession. But there's all kinds of layers to it because, of course, Nathan Fielder is interrogating his own insecurities, and he's been rehearsing things this whole time as well. And it's a very bizarre exploration of like reality television and documentary, but also like weirdly about anxiety and how we think about like social interactions ourselves and how we try to control the outcomes in situations by rehearsing things mentally or trying to like know how things will go. And it's, I love it so much. It's fascinating. Often like it's a different kind of screenwriting, but I often am just like in awe of how they must have managed to piece together a story out of like these really bizarre situations where they're just drawing from like nonfiction footage that they're collecting, and kind of like you can tell having to like evolve the story based on what is happening with the participants and those kinds of things. Yeah, it's worth checking out. If you can bear the awkwardness, it's a very it's not for people who don't have a tolerance for any level of cringe.
I feel like that's my immediate thought and fear is like that sounds really fascinating and cool, and I'm getting anxious just hearing you talk about it. I would need to like plan how I was going to watch it even, and like that's probably not the like, you know, the lesson that I should be taking away.
maybe you can get Nathan in to help you rehearse, you know, a scenario watching where you can watch the show.
That'd be meta. That's cool.
Michael, what have you been watching?
So I started Only Murders in the Building, the Hulu show.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's a really interesting show. So yeah, so it's on Hulu. Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Selena Gomez, which is like three people that I never would have expected to be in a thing. And it's, you know, about like true crime podcasters, but also they're trying to solve an actual murder. I don't know. It's a weird mishmash of things that I'm interested in. For a long time, I was in true crime and podcasts and was writing a script about it, and then was like, this is too dark and emotionally I'm always afraid I'm going to get murdered, so I need to stop listening and engaging with true crime stuff. But also the morality of like entertainment again, right? Like turning people's actual suffering into entertainment. So it's interesting watching this show kind of deal with some of that, but like through the lens of Steve Martin and Martin Short
comedy.
And it feels both old and charming and old and new and interesting and new and but as I'm watching it more, I feel like it's starting to coalesce into a thing. So it's been just a really fascinating watch. And so I'm almost at the end of season one. I look forward to season two, which I think was nominated for a bunch of Emmys recently and stuff. So and it's fun to see like Steve Martin and Martin Short again, because I grew up with them. And I'm like, oh, I'm glad they're still around doing stuff. Yeah. So only murders in the building. Awesome. Well, this has been super fun. Thank you guys so much. Like I said, there's so much to talk about with Gladiator, and I think we only like skimmed the surface, but I really appreciate just so much about it. And I'm glad that I can have a nice solid reference for it and go back and check it out all the time, potentially moving forward. Cause I've been wanting to watch it again, which is like a rare thing. Yeah, so before we wrap up, Tom and Thomas, where can people find you? Where can they watch and listen to all of your things? Do your spiel.
I'm Thomas Flight on YouTube and everywhere else. And then I co-host the podcast Cinema of Meaning with Tom, who we have lots of great discussions about movies like Gladiator. And Tom mentioned Kingdom of Heaven. We talked about that a while ago and had a very interesting discussion. Similar to Gladiator, it kind of has these like underlying themes that are very thought-provoking. But yeah, Thomas Flight everywhere and Cinema of Meaning.
You guys recently did an episode on Jurassic Park. I thought you did a fantastic job. Really enjoyed that one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was a good one. Yeah.
It's great. We'll put a link in the show notes. If you like our show, you'll definitely like it. You should check it out.
You definitely will.
And Tom, what about you?
So yeah, I'm Tom. I run the channel like Stories of Old, in which I make video essays that really basically do what we also do on the podcast, but in a more structured format. I really look at the connections between movies and philosophies and ideas and the way, and especially the how of how movies connect with us and give meaning to our lives, basically, and the way we connect with them on that more personal level. And so, yeah, that's my channel. And then, of course, there's the podcast with Thomas, Cinema of Meaning.
Your channel, Tom, like Stories of Old, is one of the first ones that I became a patron of, because I remember I remember. Because I did my Dark Knight video, and there was all this stuff that I wanted to talk about, but that didn't like make sense for like my channel or what I was doing. And then you released a video, and I was like, this is it. This is saying all the things I wanted to say and saying it better than I would have. And I got very excited. So
I felt so validated in that moment, because Lessons of the Screenplay was kind of my one of the inspirations for my channel. And then I think back then I was still really small. I only had like a couple of thousand subscribers, and then suddenly your channel popped up on my Patreon page, and I was like, what? I remember, actually, I don't know if you remember this, but I asked for your advice at one point. I think it was either before I started my channel or shortly after, and I sent you a message on Facebook.
Oh, wow.
Did
I respond?
Really?
I hope so.
Yeah, you did. Okay. It was kind of a general answer. But the funny thing is, I basically asked something along the lines of, how do I get popular? And you answered with, I don't know, post it around on Reddit or try this or that. But I remember the funny thing is, like a couple of years later, I got that exact same question from someone else who asked it to me, and I kind of passed along your answer. So I felt like I had gone full circle.
It's the circle of life.
Yeah.
The circle of YouTube.
Yes. The YouTube video says. That's awesome. That's heartwarming. Well, I'm really glad we could all be here now to do this together.
Yeah, it was fun. Kind of surreal for me, because I listened to Beyond the Screenplay a lot, and I'm not sure how you listen to a podcast, but whenever I listen to a conversational podcast, I kind of imagine myself inside the conversation, and I think of my own arguments, and I kind of imagine myself being there. And now obviously it's
here
actually happening.
Now you can listen back to this and rebut your own statements.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to do it again sometime and get the others in here also, because they would love to be part of this conversation as well.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you guys so much for joining us. To quickly wrap up, like I said, next episode, we'll be talking about Alien. We want to take a moment to say thank you to our patrons for making the show possible. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major, and our editors, Caleb Berg, Graham Harther, Eric Snyder. I'm Michael Tucker. I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Tom Vanderlinden, and Thomas Flight. Check out the show notes for Twitter's links and all the stuff. And we will see you in the next episode. Tom and Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.